This is Inside Douglas County on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN. It's our daily in-depth look at people and issues that are shaping the local area. Inside Douglas County is presented by Concrete Builder Supply. Now, Inside Douglas County on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Covering all kinds of things around the Umpqua Valley, and once in a while, it's time to look at the topic of wine. Dyson DeBar of Hillcrest Vineyards, Dan, how you doing?
Pretty good, thank you.
Well, I'm sure, I mean, you're always, you have so much going on with so many properties and so many projects here and other places. Do you ever really take a break?
My career, my life is my break. And I kid you not, I was thinking about this. I have a son and daughter that work for us, and we had this discussion the other night over a glass of wine out on our patio looking at the beautiful Callahans that... There's, you know, what is richness in life? And I define richness myself as having like a 3-hour lunch with my kids and family somewhere, drinking wine, not worrying about going back to work. That's rich. And so my kids and I, it's really like to live in such a beautiful, tranquil areas we have, but then to go dip our toes into areas of the world, big cities and eat and drink and wine country around the world. It really is, if you enjoy it, it is a way of life. And I think, you know, historically it's been that. Today, you know, in the modern world, we tend to approach a lot of things like business, but for us, very much when we're here, you know, I always joke every day is a Monday, and I mean that in a good way, but it's like if it's Sunday, whatever, we're in working in the winery, something needs to be done, or out in the vineyard and that. And so, having said that, we're bottling here in the next couple weeks, a couple days, and there's a lot of prep on the front end of that blending and different things. And then we're off to Europe for a couple weeks to go wine country in Germany, Portugal, and Spain. So there's that type of a work trip that kind of helps rejuvenate.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you about the bottling part in a minute. First off, though, how's harvest looking around the Umpqua Valley? What are you seeing for your properties? What are you seeing elsewhere?
Yeah, I can tell you. So let me tell you this. I mean, the first time anybody wrote anything about wine grape growing and that with a great understanding of it was a guy named Pliny the Elder, and that was roughly like 2550 AD, something like that. I don't remember exactly. What he wrote is very truthful even today, that you really don't know until wine is made. And I'd even argue sometimes you don't know until it's 3 to 6 months post-fermentation to really know the personality of a wine. And even in great wine regions of the world, I have a friend who, his family invented Chianti. Literally, they're the ones that came up with the idea of taking Sangiovese and putting Canaiolo Mammolo in it, called Ricasoli. And they talk, I had this discussion a couple years ago when we were talking with him, and that they really, it's still an educated guess. Somebody that's been making wine at a property for 700-800 years, it's still a guess until you really see what it is down the road. So having said that, what we have seen so far is we saw kind of an early dry spring, which woke everything up very early, earliest that I can remember that we kind of had a bud break and flowering in that. Perhaps maybe due to the warmer weather that we've had, things can slow down a little bit. I mean, the optimal temperature for photosynthesis is like 74 degrees. So when you start getting into days that are like 92, 104, sometimes it either slows or even stops photosynthesis, which can you push back your harvest date and that. We're just beginning here in the last few days to see veraison. So the oldest fruits in the world are all red or yellow fruits, and they're green when the fruit is immature, and as it begins to mature, you begin to see, and think about a tomato, you begin to see it swell and turn yellow or red. And there are reasons in nature for that, which are fascinating, I won't go into necessarily. But anyway, we're just starting to see that right now, and that gives us a little bit of an idea of when we're going to pick. And so usually you're about 45 days from the point at which half the clusters in a vineyard block have begun to pick up color, in the case of reds, of course, turning red. So that means we're looking at like middle of September. We've had a very dry year. I mean, the vines are all really, really healthy, but the real magic happens at the end. It has to do with how vines are accumulating sugar, what they're doing with the precursors that had developed during the season for flavor. And then a big one, especially with Pinot Noir, you know, 2/3 of the Appalachian is planted to Pinot Noir. Is thin-skinned varieties, if you think about like blackberries in the summer and that, you go into a creek and that, and you can smell it sometimes on a walk in the evening, that means you're taking all that perfume and cooking it through. So like a warm, warm vintage, when you have these flavors created, if certain varieties, you can cook that out and you lose that aromatic and that perfume, versus a lot of the very famous wine regions, if you've heard of Piemonte, Northern Italy, Barolo, Barbaresco wines, they say the greatest vintages are long, cool, dry growing seasons that this perfume is developed and trapped. So we don't know what that is. And So I'd argue that you really don't have a good idea of what it's about until we really get into those final days when flavors and perfumes are being kind of created and retained, hopefully.
Now, which varietals around the Umpqua Valley are harvested first? And I know that varies area to area.
Yeah. Well, here we go. Tomatoes again. I love analogies. Yeah, I think I need to have a BLT maybe. But tomatoes, which people are very familiar with, typically you have early season, mid-season, and late season varieties. Wine grapes and a lot of fruits fall within the same kind of parameters. So early season varieties for wine grapes would be things like Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Noir, Chardonnay. Mid-season would be maybe Syrah, Merlot, and then late season would be Cabernet Sauvignon, Petite Syrah, Zinfandel maybe. And if you think about, like, early season tomatoes typically don't have a lot of flavor because they've rushed to so-called ripeness in that in terms of sweetness. Mid-season varieties in almost all fruits are the most beautiful flavored, intensely sweet. And the reason for that, it has all this competition. Almost all those of that variety of fruit come into maturity, so they're competing with one another to get something to pick up the seed and carry it off. Late season varieties with, like, tomatoes are the real heavy, like Roma, typically beefsteak. And those are the ones that are kind of very fibrous and thick, and those are the ones can take like the cooler conditions as you get later in the season into the fall. And that wine grapes are exactly the same thing.
Interesting. Now, do you irrigate or do you dry farm? And explain the reason for both methods.
Yeah, so I dry farm as a very simple way of presenting it. Europe, for all intents and purposes, is dry farm by law. Wine grapes are the second deepest rooted plant known to mankind. And this is an extreme example, but 233 feet is a fossilized grapevine in Europe. Deepest rooted plant ever is a cherry tree at 460. So if you take wine grapes that are native to Soviet Georgia, Afghanistan, you've seen those. Well, of course, we've all seen pictures at this point of Afghanistan where these dried valleys with a little green line at the bottom that's a creek. These are plants that will throw a deep taproot until they hit water, and then basically they're self-pollinating in that, but they're very, very tough plants in that. So the theory is, in the old world, if you don't irrigate, it takes about 7 or 8 years. And everybody in the world until about 40 or 50 years ago, this is what you planted. You planted a vineyard. You maybe hand-watered it the first year or two when the roots only went down 10, 12 inches. But then you really starve that plant for water for the first 4 or 5 years. And basically, the roots go down, but the plant looks like it's almost dying on top. And then you get to year 4, 5, 6, and you have a massive root system. And then the plant for the next 2 or 3 years kind of develops its above-ground architecture. And then you get a plant that's very tough. So it's a little bit like kids. If you take a kid and if you irrigate a vineyard and put fertilizer, which most people do through the irrigation water, it's like giving a kid a couch, Captain Crunch, remote, and PlayStation. And at 18, what do you get? A grapevine, if you make it struggle, grapevines are not here, in the case of wine grapes, to make wine. And this is something we oftentimes get so close to it, we forget this. They're in the business of procreation and getting something to pick that seed up. Wine grapes are the sweetest fruit in the world that's not a dried fruit. It's the most chemically complex fruit in the world. That's one of the reasons it's so interesting, all the different smells and flavors. And the way a grapevine looks at its seed is it wants to hang the seed out there, but nothing will eat the seed. So what it does, it has the ability to chum and make its fruit the sweetest, tastiest. So when a bird, or initially there were only reptiles, when I said tomatoes are yellow or red, reptiles are the first things to spread seeds, and they can't see green, but they see yellow or red. So as that seed matures and can make it through the digestive tract of an animal, all of a sudden the for sale sign's out there. And so with a grapevine, it wants something to pick that seed up. And that chum, we would say, you're chumming the seed, that's what we turn into wine. And grapevines, depending upon the soil, the climate, how we interact with it, can change the flavors for good and for bad that they put around the seed.
Now, when you talked about essentially starving it for a while, even if you know the science, it would be just at first glance, I'd be out there grabbing water.
Yeah, it's human nature. I mean, we like, so when people talk about farming, they always talk about water and fertilizer and, oh, that looks really healthy. Great vineyards don't look really healthy. Great vineyards struggle. And so it's the same thing with people. Oftentimes, people that are given everything, we see a lot of this in our world, love our kids to death kind of thing, they don't develop a lot of character versus kids that are sometimes brought up into hard situations. Those are the people that really excel. It develops personality, and yeah, there's a little scarring. Same thing is true of wine grapes. If you look at places, there are places in the world that land sells for $16 million to grow a grape on, and you can take a rock and throw it to a place that's illegal to grow a grape on because the quality is so poor. And that's the difference in how that nature stresses that plant.
Wow. Tying wine, grapes, and even possibly politics. Huh?
Yeah.
We'll be back in a moment. Dyson DeMara, Hillcrest Vineyards, inside Douglas County. The interview, a podcast after 1 at 541radio.com, 1245 at News Radio, 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN. Inside Douglas County, 1248. Lars Larson coming up with one wine in the Umpqua. It is Dyson DeMara of Hillcrest Vineyards, and a lot going on with wine in the Umpqua Valley. You know, the industry, any industry has ups and downs. For wine overall, where are we at right now?
We're in a bubble like everything else. It's interesting. When I got in the business in the very early 1980s down in Napa, the old timers talked about 8 years up, 8 years down. And so you went through these cycles and that. And since 93, we've really not had a correction cycle. And typically, if you look at even like places like Chile, you know, in the 1850s, when they really began to mine copper and send it all over the world and that, the wealthy family sent their kids to Europe and the kids came back and began making wine. And so oftentimes in times that there's a lot of money being thrown around, you see the wine industry explode. And that's happened around the world. Some parts of the world, you go to Germany, you go to France, Italy, and that, they've been struggling with overproduction for quite a while. And that the U.S. has come into this in the last couple of years. There are a lot of corrections. I mean, we say, you know, roughly speaking, off of the high numbers on the West Coast, or I should say in Oregon, really, we're probably down 10, 15, 20%, something like that in tasting rooms, which is actually not bad. But there are places down in California that are off, you know, Napa Valley, like 60%. And so we have tremendous overproduction of wine. And, you know, there are, you know, health issues that people are looking at as people age out. Also, younger generation tends to, they haven't entered the wine business. When I got in the wine business, really nobody drank wine until they were 40 or 50 years old. Then we got into a point, I can remember, you know, being when we first moved up here, that I'd have like a 21-year-old, 22-year-old wine club member of ours bring their parents in who were in their 50s to introduce them to wine. And I was like, wow, that's kind of a reversal. You know, and so there are a lot of changes like there are in everything else in the world. But it's a good thing, too, because we have, to be honest, you know, around the world, there's a lot of new, but it's not always good. And so it's important to have people kind of redirect and either to get the message like you need to make a better product, or maybe somebody else should take a crack at it, or maybe we have too many wineries. It's kind of the half cup, you know, is it too full, too empty, or just right, you know, kind of thing.
When it comes to tasting rooms, is some of that like the cultural shift that has impacted restaurants as well when it comes to tasting rooms? I mean, people, they'll go to their store and they'll buy the wine and hope they like it, mm-hmm. You know, versus going in and making the tasting room an experience.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's really, that is the face of the winery. And it always is amazing to me. I've been in the business 43 years now. And you go to wineries that people have invested $50, $60 million. And you walk in, you have a horrible tasting room experience because somebody's not happy on the other side of the counter. And that is the experience. That is the face of the winery in that. And so that's something that, you know, I think that to be a successful winery, it's not just a question. We see more and more wineries are kind of like wine deli, wine bar where you go in, you get charcuterie plate, nobody ever talks to you about the wine, half the wine's purchased from another winery or whatever. It's just kind of like a business in the country, and having a winery permit allows you to do that. But the people that will do well are the people that really kind of promote wine and develop wine customers. And it's something, you know, when I got in the business, I mean, for a young person to get in the business was very, very unusual, but people were farmed. You went into a tasting room and there were people that were very knowledgeable, and it was an experience of telling you about the winery, not going in and grabbing a glass and sitting back and waiting for your pizza to be delivered. And so the wine industry has a lot of growing to do and understanding of like who we are and how we got here, but showing people how we use wine and what a beautiful, you know, it's been around forever and it will be, I believe, because it's something that adds to everyday life. I mean, I think about the most important thing to me besides my family really is sharing food at the table with my family, and wine is part of that, and it's something that's super, super beautiful that is very different than if you get into spirits or beer. You know, most people don't sit down and have a, you know, 7 and 7 with the 10-year-olds at the table kind of thing. And so wine is this beautiful beverage of moderation that, you know, in the modern world, you know, for many reasons, is, you know, it's being used in a different way and kind of will going forward, but it's a magic beverage.
You're bottling on Friday, and you mentioned that as we were trading emails earlier. And I realized that I've not really ever watched that whole process. Is it is this sort of date timed or what? Talk about the day of bottling. What goes into all this?
Yeah, it's. I used to have an incredible neighbor. Some of you might know him, Carl Fraun. He was a very famous mechanic in the area. But anyway, he said farming was just another name for fixing equipment. And when it comes to bottling, I have a $250,000 Italian bottling line, which is like a little overkill for a winery my size. But you can ruin wines at bottling. So you can spend a year, 2 years, or I spend a lot of 3 to 4 to 5, 6 years getting a wine from grape to bottle. You can ruin a wine bottling it incorrectly. But it's one of these things, it's kind of like maintenance. And so the thing is like we're getting wines ready to run them through. And we'll typically get up really early in the morning, sterilize a line with steam, wait for the line to cool down, and then start feeding lots in. So we'll have like small tanks, in our case, maybe 500 gallons of wine at a time. We'll push it through, and we'll have a machine that basically takes the bottle, injects nitrogen into it, so oxygen's not introduced at that point. Then it goes to a filler where gravity flow very gently comes down. And how it hits, how the wine hits the glass on the inside is important. Does it hit the outside and then run down? Does it go down the middle, splash? All those things are important. Then it goes around. There's something in our case that actually it hits it with a little bit of nitrogen again on top, and then it checks fill level. It puts the cork in, checks the cork, and then we pack it off. And I do that maybe 5 or 6 days of the year. And it's just one of these things. It's a little bit Rube Goldberg. There's a lot of parts and pieces in that. And so, you know, the complexity of a bottling system minus like hand bottling, which we did in the early days, it's not ideal. But for small wineries, usually you don't have the budget to buy, you know, a machine, a great quality machine that you use 5 days a year.
And is it a bit nerve-wracking? I mean, one mistake and your accountant is on your case.
Yeah. Actually, it's interesting. I was talking to somebody recently, and they contract bottled for someone, and they had a multi-million dollar lawsuit that they had to cough up money. She's my vernacular there. To cover wine that had gone bad in bottling. So the thing is it can be catastrophic to a winery, definitely. Now, if you're making 100 cases, if you're smart, you don't stick it in front of a customer. I've been into tasting rooms, we all have, where I think they put that out in the tasting room. But for the most part, it's wine is agriculture, it's production and marketing, and you have to be pretty good at all of those things. And so, you know, that's a hard thing to master. I mean, nobody grows wheat, makes bread, and sells bread. You know, because that's complex. And so in winemaking, that's the case. You have to be a little bit of a master of all things. The most important thing, which brings us right around to Umpqua Valley, is the nature. You've got to have the nature to make great wines. And that's a particular equilibrium of soils and climate. And there's no gauge or meter. You can go stick out in the dirt and go, oh, this is the place. But the thing is, this area has nature equal to any wine region of the world. Like I said, I've been in the business 43 years. I've worked when I was at Mondavi, an international farming group that looked at new areas, old areas. What could we learn from them? What areas can we go into? And this area is as great as anything I've ever seen.
Couple minutes left. Summer wine, I know whites get more popular. What about refrigeration? Can you get a wine too cool?
You can get a wine too cool. First rule is drink it however you like it. I like champagne too cold, according to what people say. But if I'm paying $150 for a bottle of champagne, I'm drinking how I like. I don't need any input there. But yeah, think about fruit. So you really get into red wine and drier whites, we could say like 50, 55, 60 degrees. Then the fruitier whites, which would be like Gewurztraminer, Riesling, what gives them their smell is very different. So like a Chardonnay, a Cabernet, get their smell from what are called esters, and below 50 degrees, the ester can't rise up, and you smell almost everything you enjoy in a wine. You enjoy texture in that, but smells, when you put wine in your palate, there's a cavity that goes up into your nasal cavity, and that's where you pick up the smell of a wine. So smelling tells us almost everything. When you look at Muscat and Gewurztraminer, they're what are called terpenes, and those compounds that give them their smell, even at like 40 and 30 degrees, they're still really volatile. So you go to a great restaurant, and they'll make a sorbet, and they'll make it out of like Muscat or Riesling, and they'll make this ice out of it to kind of cleanse your palate, but you'll still be able to taste it. So I'd say drink what you like. Fruity whites is a simple rule. Refrigerator, you know, dry whites and that, I would say, you know, how you like it, but I'd say I drink most of that stuff at 50, 55. Depends on the day. If it's really hot, maybe I'd chill it down a little more.
What's your favorite food item to pair with a summer wine?
Oh my God. right now, what are we doing? We are doing a little piece of tuna with a little piece of pickled pepper, like a bell pepper pickled with a little anchovy on top, skewered.
That's very different.
That's very different. It goes some parts of the world, that's like normale. Yeah, that's a kind of pretty famous tapa from Spain.
All right. If people want to find out more about what you're doing, talk about your website address real quick.
Yeah, hillcrestvineyard.com. We're out in Melrose. We're open all but 4 days of the year, and we'd love to pour you some of our. We were just recognized by the largest international wine group, Slow Wine, and we're the only winery in Umpqua Valley, not only for the quality of our wines, but for how we treat nature and our hands-off approach.
All right. Dyson DeBar, Hillcrest Vineyards, thanks for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
1257 News Radio, 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Listening to Inside Douglas County on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN. A daily look at the people and issues that are shaping Douglas County. It's presented by Concrete Builder Supply. The show will be available as a podcast in just a few minutes at 541radio.com. So share it around and let others who weren't listening live know about today's show. Inside Douglas County is a public affairs presentation of Brook Communications. Stay connected with local news and information. News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.